Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So it's Vesak full moon. So we have a chance to reflect on the life of the Buddha. For those of you who have imbibed that story, each of you have your own best parts of the story. I often reflect on that story as an archetype of human achievement. There's oftentimes argumentation about the historical accuracy of this or that fact. Where does myth come into story, come into historical accuracy? That's one way to look at it. But another way is to try to reflect on it as, how does it reflect your own human experience? How does it connect to who you are as a human being and your own aspiration? And so as an archetype, the idea of the Buddha's deep compassion, that his seeing of the world and the suffering of the world was deeply connected, he had a deep empathy for life. We had this robin's nest on a pine tree outside the Bhikkhu Vihara, and the last windstorm knocked it out, and there were three fledglings. They hadn't started fledglings, did they fly? Anyway, three baby birds who were feathered but weren't yet flying. And they'd been eaten. So they fell out of the nest. One was still alive. The mum was all, and both the male and the female were all distressed. The next thing I saw, one of the birds, the chest had been ripped open, babies. And then I looked, now they're all gone. Vanished. So the kind of violence in nature. It's very beautiful seeing a baby bird and seeing the robins twittering around, and then the wind and death and so on. And my sense of the Buddha's life was one that he was kind of deeply concerned about existence itself, but he wasn't sentimental. Sentimentality to me, poor little birds. But I think the contemplations I like to consider in the life of the Buddha, you say, yeah, but we're all in this. We're all subject to death. We all have loss, and we all feel pain, we all suffer when we see our loved ones die. Is there something more profound? Is there something deeper in life than just this endless cycle of birth and death and natural violence and natural beauty? And that deep empathy of his was one of the reasons he was able to teach for so long with such power. But his empathy, first of all, was very, very pragmatic, because he realized that he can't really talk about anything if he hasn't understood the way out. And so the story of the Devaduttas is always, as we all know, is always a very powerful story for me, archetype, where he's a successful, wealthy, powerful, influential, talented, beautiful being. He's got all the kind of worldly things. Probably the best chariot in town, white, with BMW written in the front. But he wasn't enthralled by chariots. Nor was he enthralled by a double-double or a chocolate chill. He wasn't taken by the world of things and the world of luxury and the world of privilege and the world of power and all of that, which is so very important in worldly dharmas. In fact, he was quite bored with it. Satiated beyond boredom. And so that takes him to a sense of questioning. And so the archetype story is that he decides to elude the protection of his family, the comfort of his distractions, the attempt of his family to keep him naive in states of luxury and sense indulgence. He evades that, which for me is a kind of metaphor for consumerism. And consumerism is something that's always trying to lull our minds into stupidity, really. You just think about the way we deal with things, it's constant distraction. Anyway, he doesn't buy into that. And he asks his charioteer to go into the village, into the marketplace, into the real world, and he goes and he sees for the first time in his life, as you know the story, he sees an old man, an old person, really old, really old, bent over with osteoporosis and weak, barely able to walk, and he's never seen this before. Now, as an archetype, that's the moment in our lives when we see old age. You know, when we see old age, that, yeah, this body is like that body. It's a kind of empathy, a waking up call. And sometimes people only get that very, very late, very, very late. But he sees it as a young man, as a strong man. And he says, yeah, that's my lot too. And he's quite taken, you know, he's disturbed by that. He's really disturbed by this, disturbed by old age. And in youth culture, in case old age is just dismissed. So they kind of, come on, old man, drive more quickly. Get off the road. People are retired and so on. And he sees something very profound in that, his own predicament. And so the conceit of youth falls away from him. And youth is a conceit, because youth doesn't see old age, it always thinks it's going to be young. And then another occasion arises in a similar way in China, and he just sees a sick person, and person's writhing in their vomit, writhing in pain, really awful, awful to look at, and he's never seen that before. And again, it's like, say, people who think everything is hunky-dory, and all of a sudden they get cancer. And all of a sudden the world just takes on a different meaning. All the trivialities and all the pettiness and all that distraction and whatever, all of a sudden life becomes a more serious venture. And so for him, he sees that and he asks China, what's that? China says, that's a sick person. You've never seen that? And he's never seen that. He's never noticed it. And that's very true for a healthy body. And the conceit of good health falls away from him. I always like to give the example, like if everyone else has the flu and you don't, you kind of feel proud, oh, I don't have the flu. You get a little bit of conceit there. And he sees the conceit of good health falls away. So here's a being who is deeply questioning. You know, he's not just psychologically maladjusted to being a king. He sees it's much more profound than that. And then another occasion, him and China come across a corpse first time. And that really strikes him incredibly profoundly. And he asks China, and China says, yeah, we all die. You're going to die. And the conceit of life falls away from him. And you think about our culture, how we hide away death in our mortuary institutions. It's a really lost opportunity. Really lost opportunity. When I went with Andrew to take my mom to the crematorium, and I asked how many people actually accompany their relatives as far as the burning ovens. And he said about 10%. People don't want to know. They don't want to see it. let the mortician take care of it. And there's something about our culture that it's kind of immature that way. Or we don't even know we can do that, maybe. But these are very powerful things, very powerful. They're what we call the heavenly messengers, Devadutas, signs of the importance of this existence, not for distraction, but for liberation, for understanding, for a kind of deeper meaning, I think. And then the fourth messenger, of course, he's out and about, and now he's feeling very, very concerned, very, you know, confused and even depressed, maybe. What is it? What is my existence about? If I'm going to, these people die, I die. And he sees a holy man meditating. And of course he asks Channa, what's that? Channa says, oh, that's someone who is, and the version I like, is someone who is seeking the deathless. And for me that's a very, very important part of the Buddha's aspiration, seeking the deathless, the uncreated. And that's not something that really exists in Western philosophy, Western thought. It might be somewhere in some kind of mystical things that I don't know about, but this is an idea that was very powerful in India and still is, the deathless. So there is this kind of philosophy and worldview that existence is fraught with difficulties, and that there is a possibility not just of distraction and consumption and sort of just putting a band-aid on the whole mess, but actually discovering something which is profoundly different to deathless. And that inspires Siddhartha, and inspires him to take the great renunciation. So you think about it, here he is, he has all that power, none of it is worth it, and it just goes off as a mendicant seeking truth. Powerful story, very powerful story, gives it all up. And then his seeking, you think about the seeking, again, as an archetype, he checks out all the teachers, no, that's not deathless, it's still constructed. And it's still something that's fabricated and made, and if I don't, you know, if I just have to put effort forth to maintain that, then it falls apart, then that can't be it either. So he attains to everything teachers have to offer. So he's obviously a very hugely gifted being, a lot of gifts, power of meditation, and then his own struggle with asceticism, that sense of trying to get rid of, deny, self-mortification, 5-6 years of that. So this extreme use of willpower then, and we've had that, I think any meditator who's come to this practice, you know, when we begin, most of us are very willful, really just try. People, you know, do their backs in, do their knees in, which seems like the way to do it. It seems like if you just really, really try hard, you'll be enlightened or happy or free from anger. It doesn't work. It doesn't work because willpower will not do. It takes wisdom. And so then the Buddha is kind of insight from failure. And that's a big part of the spiritual life, is that, you know, all of us are very sincere in this. We're not out there chasing the baubles. We're very sincere in this work. We get distracted, sure, but there's something very sincere about us. And that sincerity, if one stays with that and stays honest to that sincerity, then mistakes will teach you. If you can reflect, well, this way of operating gives a fearful result. This way of operating gives an alienating result. This way of operating separates me from human beings. There's this other way of operating, liberates my mind from greed, hatred, and delusion, unifies me with people, brings me more empathy, more compassion, more connectedness, more peace. Very simple, very pragmatic. Nothing too fancy about that. And so in Thai, they say, pit pin kru, mistake is teacher. If one has the resilience and fortitude and honesty to really look at the problem is my mind. It's not out there. It's not out there. And so we come to this aspiration, many of us in a similar way. You know, if you take that archetype, we become disillusioned with consumer society or getting things or doing things or that. And we've contemplated deeply, perhaps, maybe we've been affected by death. Certainly when in Thailand, death was much more close. You know, if someone died, you'd be invited to the village and you'd go to Adana and see the dead person and do chanting, and then the burning would be in the monastery. So in Wat Anachat itself was a charnel ground, but we would the villagers would invite us into their homes, which are simple farm homes. We do chanting in the evening. The person that had died, next day, or maybe 2 days, they would bring that same body, build a funeral pyre, put the body on the pyre, and it would be lit. We'd do chanting, and we'd watch. We'd watch all night as the body burned. And this kind of imagery is we couldn't do it here. You know, when I die, I'd love you to burn me. You know, just, we got lots of wood, make a nice pile, and just watch Varadhamma go up in flames. They do it in India, they do it in Benares, don't they? And that seems kind of ghoulish in our culture. You know, it's not very sanitary, tie it all up. But the effect on the mind, I remember once seeing one body being burnt and the ligaments shortened. So this, I forget if the person, the dead body, sat up or the arm went up and freaked me out completely. It's just the ligaments burning. But, you know, looking at that for like 4 hours, just watching, going back and forth and meditating and walking, that has a very, very powerful effect on the mind. Different than riding in a BMW and having a doubled up, different kind of effect. And these kinds of reflections, we're not meant to negate life, not to negate anything, but just to see, well, if this is my lot, is there another alternative? And the thing about faith in the Buddha is that the Buddha discovers something. He is successful in his quest. And he says, I have realized, there is realization, there is the deathless, there is the unconditioned, that is possible. And then he says, this is where you can do it. So you either believe him or you don't. You either go for it or you don't. So it's not like he formulated a teaching from some abstract virtual reality that he penned, and then somehow got something out of it. No, his teaching was pragmatic, from realizing something, and then from that realization he offers up teachings which can be verified, which you can practice, which you can do, and the verification is up to you. It's up to you to prove it, believe it or not. So if someone says to me, well, I don't think the Buddha got enlightened, fine. Or I don't believe in enlightenment, I don't believe in the deathless, that's fine too. So the Buddha's not sort of negotiating with anyone, saying, oh, come on, please believe in me. He said, there is this possibility. If you want to do it, this is what you should do, this is what you should try. So it's very, very, it's not abstract. It's more like today, yesterday, I was putting up some towel rails, and I couldn't find a stud. And if you've ever done plaster wall boards and you can't find the stud, you know how you can find large holes in the plaster board after a while. But Kamiko came to the rescue and helped me out. And that's very pragmatic, isn't it? How to put up something. It's not abstract. It's not like a theory about something. It's like, right there, this is what you have to do. If you don't find that stud, you're not going to get that thing on the wall. You get it on the wall, but it'll fall off as soon as someone pulls on it. And in the same way, the Buddhist teachings are pragmatic. And it's not a matter of having the right opinion about it, because that's what happens in any religious institutions such as this is that the opinions start to become fast and furious, and so the abstract philosophies grow afterwards. So you have a whole, in universities they study Buddhology, the different ways the word Buddha is used in the Mahayana, in the Theravada. And then you have philosophy upon philosophy, abstraction upon abstraction, but that's the later commentaries. But if you just look at what the Buddha is saying, he's saying, what you have to do is you have to figure out your own suffering. That's your challenge. And if you're suffering, you're always going into states of greed, hatred, and delusion, then there's something you don't understand. You haven't got it yet. You haven't nailed it yet. And so there's many, many ways to look at that. But human suffering is something that we take as mature beings, we take responsibility for it. And that is a big step in human consciousness. Rather than think that somehow, if I create external situations, somehow I'll be free from suffering. That doesn't work that way. External situations can be helpful for reflection, and so a monastery is helpful, but you can really suffer in a monastery still. You really suffer. So what is it about our minds which begin to experience peace? Why do we begin to be free from fear? Why do we begin to be free from hatred? Why do we begin to be really at ease with life? Or the other, why are we always uptight? Why are we always in contention? Why are we always hankering for something or lusting for something? Why are we always caught up with obsessive mental realms of fear and worry? Why is that? Why does that happen? When do we start to really experience some kind of profound peace? When isn't it just a kind of circumstantial peace? Circumstantial peace is easy, isn't it? You get all the conditions right, the weather's right, the deer's right, you had a good meal, the fawn is jumping through the fields, and everyone thinks, oh, it's so peaceful here. But that's just circumstantial. The circumstances have just created a certain amount of sense deprivation, beauty, and one is grateful. But when the conditions change, where are you at? Right? So there is circumstantial peace, which is what we try to make here. We try to make an environment which is peaceful. But then there's the stuff of our conditioning. There's the stuff of obsessive worry and fearfulness all the time, and alienation and self-consciousness and resentment and judging others all the time, or fantasizing about this, and the mind just kind of gone. No peace in the mind. So the way to, in many ways you can look at that, but one of the fundamental things is that we try to begin to get away from the personal and see the phenomenon of mind, to see the phenomenon of fear, the phenomenon of worry, the phenomenon of obsessiveness. And that's hard to do. To see for a person who is obsessed, to see the phenomenon of obsession is very hard. Someone was just telling me that someone in their family, a girl, has taken on a website on anorexia, and she's going down that horrible, horrible train of anorexia, and she believes it totally. Parents, good parents, got everything she could have. She's just gotten caught in obsession of anorexia. And how do you see that? How does an obsessive person see obsession? I had a doctor here the other day. She said, nowadays, people come to her and they've self-diagnosed through Google. And they've, of course, taken the worst 1%. And then she has the difficult judgment, okay, is she going to put people through these different tests when she's 99% sure it's not this diagnosis? So you have stuff called cyberchondria. They're just like obsessed. They read something and they're just obsessed with it. What's that? Now, if a person cannot see that obsession as an object of mind, they are doomed. There's that word again. Because they're just victims of their thinking mind, victims of their position taking and attachment to views and so on. And this girl, say, she can justify it. She said, no, I don't believe you, Mom. It says here, and all the rational mind, but the rational mind now is driven, thought, driven by this horrible, horrible viewpoint, horrible suffering. So what Buddhism tries to do is try to somehow extract us from that and begin to look at in the social conventions of precepts and moral responsibility and such like, try to step away from the narrative to the phenomenon. That's a huge step in humanity for a person who is fearful and obsessed to actually look at the obsession, the fearful obsession, as an object of mind. Now, for the obsessed person, they cannot do that because they always need some kind of external reassurance. And so they get the external reassurance and they feel safe for a while, but as soon as that external reassurance is somehow undermined, they fall back into their fearful obsession. It's not the way out. It's not through external. It's the capacity to look at greed, hatred, and delusion as an object that has arisen. And so we have the five khandhas teachings. The five khandhas teachings are a way of depersonalizing that which is individual. It's still individual. Each of us has a different set of memories and bodily feelings and the rest of it. But it can be observed in an objective way. That's the beginning of true peace. True peace, not just circumstantial peace, not just a kind of readjustment of circumstances to make people feel somewhat safe, but actually a profound shift from self-identity to objective observation. Self-identity to objective. So the girl who is obsessed now with anorexia is total self-identity. That's who she is. And whatever parents say, and she'll find any website to prove it. And this is when the rational mind is employed by delusion. That's the problem. So sometimes that can be cultural. So we have these, like, I was thinking the other day about butter. I read an article about butter and whole milk, how the FDA determined that milk fat was bad for you, and so they encouraged margarine and this horrible skim milk, and the result of it was, of course, that we got to eat margarine. My mother never believed in this, and now we have lots of cheese on our pizzas because they didn't know what to do with the milk fat. And they processed in the cheese in mountains and mountains and mountains of cheese. So then they started to push the cheese on us. Now, from what I read, okay, that, oh, butter's okay, milk fat's okay, or something like that. But what, I don't know, I didn't follow the argument so well, but what I'm pointing to is that you oftentimes have these kind of cultural orthodoxies, aren't they? And everyone believes in them. So sometimes they're good, sometimes they're good, but sometimes they're just the views and opinions of our culture. We call it sila bhatta paramasa, belief in rites and rituals. So in Thailand, say, like there's a lot of belief in amulets. Amulets give you power, protect you, which is not so much a Western problem. But we have our own obsessions, our own kind of belief in kind of cultural norms. And we have all these subcultures too. So one of the things we want to do is all the shoulds and shouldn'ts. Where does fear arise in your mind? Fear is fear rather than some kind of cultural conditioning that you might have. So taking it personally, being caught up in the kind of cultural obsessions, cyberchondria, hypochondria, obsessions with religions are very famous for being paranoid about rules and rule keeping, sinful, that kind of mindset, fearful mindset. And the way out is to no longer have any more doubt that that which has arisen will pass away. And it's that perspective, being utterly confident, utter faith in the Buddhist teaching that anything that has arisen will pass. And it's not, you are not that. That's not who you are. It cannot be. That perspective and that combination of perspectives of not being engaged personally in this movement, but seeing it as a movement, seeing this is just weather, this is just body, this is just emotions, these are just feelings, these are just parts of nature. They have the nature to arise, the nature to cease. No longer being caught in the rule, fearfulness of our society. And there's a lot of fear that's generated by kind of cultural obsessions. And the sense of having utter confidence in that gives you the perspective, then the conditions, the karmic conditions of greed, hatred, and delusion begin to fall away. Because there's no longer any self-belief in them, because you're no longer driven by fear, and because your mind is absolutely confident and knows anicca dukkha anatta. It sees clearly this is anicca dukkha, moment by moment by moment by moment. And then let Mara come. And Mara does come. This perspective, quite often more things come up, because much of our life might have been spent, even as meditators, with substituting things, which is all right. Just substituting one state for another state, the good guys for the bad guys. But somehow the deepest peace in the mind lies in having the tremendous patience and trust that these things will cease. Allowing things to manifest. So, say for the girl who is obsessed now with anorexia, she has to somehow see that and get out of it. But for us who are obsessed by fears, to actually feel a fear, and not seek a compensation for it, to not seek an answer for it, but to just be the knower of fear, with utter confidence that this will change, this will cease. That's where the deepest peace comes. Because that kind of viewing is free from desire. And the person who is caught, like me, someone who has strong lustful feelings, and they try to get rid of those lustful feelings, that won't work. Someone who is angry tries to get rid of angry feelings, that won't work. But someone who is angry and has ill will and is very critical and judgmental and finally one day sees, oh, that's an object. That mind which is now putting everyone else down, that's an object. That's not me. I can see it. I can see it as a feeling, as a condition, as a narrative in thought. It's a thought. And the person begins to be the knowing, be the Buddha, no change. Now that takes a lot of endurance, because now maybe a habit which has been going on a long time is seen for what it is. It's no longer like before that, it might be just like the critical judging mind is just compensated by self-judging. So the critical judging mind is saying, you're doing this wrong, it shouldn't be that, and that shouldn't be that, that shouldn't be that. And then the person just judges themselves, I shouldn't be like that, it's the same thing. And then one day, there's the awakening to all those three factors. This is just an object. It's changing. And then if the person is really patient there, and this might come at them day upon day upon day, but if the person is very, very attentive and really knows anicca, dukkha, anatta, then eventually the momentum of this begins to lessen. The vipaka karma of this begins to not be fed anymore. It's not fueled anymore. And the mind begins to realize release. This walks away, goes away from the mind. There's the liberation from this. There's the cessation of this. There's the ending of this. Not because one has bashed it or gotten something else, because it's force now. It's fuel. It's the fire of this is abating because there's not attachment, there's not grasping. And so fear ends, so anger ends, so greed ends. I think when we begin the practice, I think all of us, you know, we do use like willfulness and being very good people. We have high aspirations, high ideals. And in the beginning, the practice is very, very much of just trying to get rid of things and not be a bad person. And there's some profit in that. One becomes more skilled. But the real liberation of the heart, I think, comes from a heck of a lot of patience and a deep, deep understanding that the knowing of change is liberation. That's what the liberated mind is about. And when the forces of delusion and Mara come, so we have that, you know, the idea that just before the enlightenment, Mara comes, and there's all kinds of evil, lustful, horrible beings coming at the Buddha, and you know the story too, where the Buddha calls the earth to witness. And for me, it's like the Buddhist, for me, it's like someone, a practitioner saying, I've done the work, I know this path. You know, enlightenment is the result of this work, of this path. And so the archetypal story is that, so some of you don't know it, where the great sea deity, this feminine deity, comes out of the oceans, and she has long, long hair, and she wrings her hair, and there's a great ocean and sweeps delusion away. The delusion is just swept away, and the Buddha gets enlightened. Archetype stories. But when sometimes we do start to just face up to our fears, and no longer just rationalize them in all kinds of ways, when we just sit with the burning fear of an obsessive mind, we get back and we get to the root rather than its narrative. You know, like this poor girl is kind of caught up in her anorexic obsession, just caught up in narratives. But the work of meditation is like, you know, when fear comes up, see it before thought, feel it, know it before the narrative. Takes courage. Doubt. See doubt as a condition. You know, feel it. Anger. Judging. Resentment. What is it like before we proliferate on? Before we create a self and another? Before we create me and it. Me and him. Some kind of scenario. What is it like in its rawness? And that's the perspective of non-attachment, non-grasping. But the desire mind, of course, doesn't want to do that. It wants to get rid of it, judge it. So in the courage of that, it's like really burning with that. And many traditions talk about that, Sufism, the kind of burning of the heart. Ajahn Chah, he's in the forest and it's all falling apart and he cries. And so suffering is not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing if we let it become conscious. And letting something become conscious, like greed, hatred, and delusion, and all its manifestations, fears, is a difficult one. It's a really difficult one. But how else are you going to be free from fear? Obsessing with one thing and obsessing with another thing, blaming one person, blaming another person, blaming yourself, fantasizing over this, it's endless. So we stick it out, we wait it out, we watch, we observe. And in the observation, the storm goes through us, but if we have faith, strong determination, patience, willingness to endure all those things, we watch the fire, and the desire mind doesn't want to be there, but the courage allows us to be there, then we begin to experience the end of things and this deep peace in the mind. And it's not the peace of replacement. It's the peace of the mind now being freed from that, those obsessions. And that's unassailable. You know, that's not dependent on conditions. It's not contingent on things, because now the mind is liberated from those things. So the work of what the Buddha prescribes for us is arduous. It requires a deep honesty, and it's not something that's done from mere speculation or superstition. It's done from really looking at suffering and the end of suffering. So if your practice is bringing you to the end of suffering, then you know, this works. But if it's not, you have to recalibrate. What am I doing? Why are the same kind of scenarios arise with people, with myself? Why does it keep coming? What's going on? Why is my practice? What does my practice need? Okay, I'll offer that for your reflection.
Mandamayam dhammagataya sadhu karangadamase
sadhu.